Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Coming up, another British Airways flight headed for Washington is grounded for security issues.
I've been covering airport security since 9/11, and I have never seen this level of security of unprecedented depth, such as canceling flights.
Also, North Korea says it will allow U.S. experts in to inspect a nuclear facility and responds to a well-respected reporter in Iraq carrying a gun for his protection.
You have to protect them somehow. I just don't feel that a reporter walking around packing heat is the appropriate way.
These stories and author Michael Pollan on Mad Cow, coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. For the second day in a row, British Airways has canceled one of its three flights from London's Heathrow Airport to Dulles International just outside Washington, D.C. A spokesman for British Airways cites security concerns as the reason. Robert Hall reports the cancellation was announced just 2 hours before takeoff.
The question mark that has hung over flight BA223 did not deter hundreds of passengers from reporting to London's Heathrow Airport 3 hours before its scheduled departure. But even as they queued at the check-in desks, airline management were taking fresh advice from security services. British Airways had determined to press ahead with the flight until the last possible moment. At 1:15 local time, with less than 2 hours to go, the word cancelled flashed onto information screens. Some passengers wept with frustration, others expressed relief that the security surrounding this flight was so thorough. The reason for the new alert is unclear, and doubt still remains over whether tomorrow's flight can go ahead. For NPR News, I'm Robert Hall in London.
The U.S. Army has confirmed that enemy fire brought down a U.S. helicopter near the Iraqi town of Fallujah, west of Baghdad. One American soldier was killed and another injured in the crash. The BBC's Chris Hogg has details.
The Americans say the small military helicopter used for reconnaissance missions came down around lunchtime near Fallujah. It normally carries a crew of two. Fallujah is a town west of Baghdad, which is one of Saddam Hussein's former strongholds. In recent months, there's been much unrest there. 2 months ago, insurgents shot at and brought down a Chinook transport helicopter, killing 16 soldiers just outside the city. They had been on their way out of Iraq for rest and recuperation.
The BBC's Chris Hogg. U.S. officials say some American experts have asked to visit North Korea's main nuclear site as part of their trip to North Korea next week. They're not part of the Bush administration. The delegation includes congressional staffers and a former top U.S. nuclear scientist. A member of the delegation says the visit to the nuclear site has not been finalized. Outsiders have not been allowed there since North Korea expelled U.N. nuclear inspectors about a year ago. Parts of California are reeling from the second major winter storm of the week. It's brought heavy rain in the valleys and deep snow to the mountains. And meteorologist Johnny Powell says Mother Nature isn't through yet.
Here comes number three. We've had one on Monday, and then we had one New Year's Day. And then on Monday, it looks like number three, which is about the same as the last two storms.
The first two storms knocked out power to 200,000 people, caused widespread flooding, and forced some highway closures. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials up 51 points to 10,505. The Nasdaq's up 16 to 2020. The S&P is up 5. This is NPR. In NPR's Business Update, a Wall Street Journal survey is predicting job growth in the coming year. The paper surveyed 54 economists. Their consensus is that the jobless rate will drop to 5.5% by next November. The paper says that could translate into more than 1.5 million new jobs in 2004. The nation's manufacturing sector expanded for a sixth straight month in December. That's according to a survey of purchasing and supply managers that measures activity in a variety of manufacturing industries. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The stronger-than-expected rise in the index from the Institute for Supply Management indicates an area of the economy that led the nation into recession and has been painfully slow to emerge now appears to be on much firmer footing. The group says its manufacturing index for December stood at 66.2, its highest level in 20 years. Any number over 50 denotes expansion rather than contraction in manufacturing. According to the survey, there was expansion in 17 of the 20 industries that make up the index. The report also showed production and employment at manufacturing firms moving higher, while a component that measures new orders to factories hit its highest level in more than 50 years. The upbeat report is likely to provide a bit of extra momentum for Wall Street on the first trading day of the new year. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Bethlehem Steel is no more. The company officially dissolved a minute before the new year began. During its heyday in the 1940s, Bethlehem Steel was a giant in the industry, employing 300,000 people. The company declared bankruptcy in 2001 and sold most of its remaining assets last May. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine, FFR, reports this month on the nitty-gritty of police reform, on the web at fordfound.org.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is away. It's Here and Now. Another flight from London's Heathrow Airport to Washington Dulles was canceled today, bringing the number of flights disrupted over the New Year's holiday to 7. And British Airways Flight 223 has now been canceled for 2 consecutive days. The same flight on New Year's Eve was trailed by U.S. fighter jets and detained on the tarmac at Dulles for almost 4 hours while some passengers were questioned. These unprecedented steps come as officials say they're hearing increased levels of intelligence chatter, raising concerns about specific flight routes and dates. Sarah Gu reports on airline security for The Washington Post. Sarah, do we have any specifics on this latest cancellation of Flight 223?
Well, the decision of the British Airways flights is made by the British government, not U.S. officials, although it's safe to assume that U.S. officials are consulting in what's going on. All they can say at this point is that it's for security reasons, but we do know from our sources in recent weeks that FBI officials and other security officials have been combing through passenger lists on very specific international routes coming into the United States, and routes from Europe to Dulles and Los Angeles have been some of those flights.
So, Sarah, on New Year's Eve, what happened to the British Airways flight that was detained on the tarmac at Dulles? U.S. officials didn't have the passenger list in advance, and so they only had it once the plane was airborne.
Right. As you may recall, in a really rather dramatic scene, which happened here at Dulles on New Year's Eve, late into the evening, some passengers on a British Airways flight were stuck in, held and questioned by FBI agents as the clock turned to the new year. What happened in that particular case was U.S. officials did not receive the passenger list in time. They're supposed to get them from the airline on wheels up, in other words, before it leaves Heathrow. And in this case, they didn't get that until the flight was already airborne. And as it turned out, there were a couple of hits or names on the passenger list that seemed suspicious.
Why would a name seem suspicious?
Well, the FBI and other intelligence agencies keep numerous databases of suspected terrorists or people that they want to question. And many of these names are common names, the equivalent, as it's described to me, as John Smith. Well, just because someone has an identical name doesn't mean that that's, in fact, the terrorist that the U.S. government is interested in questioning. So just for extra precautions under this Code Orange alert, authorities are taking super, super precautious steps to make sure that if they get a hit or a match on a suspicious name, they're going to go to all lengths to make sure that that is thoroughly vetted out.
And do you understand that in some of that vetting this past week, they discovered, for instance, that a 7-year-old girl had the same name as a name on a terrorist list?
Right. And you'd be surprised. This actually happens rather commonly on many flights. This particular last few weeks, It's just been that authorities have been on cautious, very heightened state of alert.
Well, Sarah, we also hear that passengers who were detained are telling us that FBI officials came on board and were questioning, for instance, a Middle Eastern woman about why she wasn't traveling with her husband. So it appears to be more than just names on a list.
Well, certainly I know that the FBI agents, once they questioned those passengers in Dulles, they were targeting not everybody. They did question a lot of people, but they were only questioning certain people that they wanted to see on this list. And the questions and the details, we don't know specifically other than what passengers tell us, but nobody was arrested in that case, and that's the bottom line, and that obviously they did not find who they might have been looking for.
Yeah. You were also reporting, and you mentioned that some foreign flights are being escorted by U.S. fighter planes, which has got to be a sobering thought for those people on the foreign airlines seeing this fighter jet out the window, because why are they there, the fighter jets?
Well, it's funny. When people were reading that, they were saying, oh, that's really great, Sarah. They have these fighter jets. That makes me feel more secure. And then on the second thought, they said, well, actually, no. If I was on that plane, the fighter jets are flying there to possibly shoot down the aircraft if that flight goes off course. Now, officially, some of the U.S. officials are telling us that these fighter jets are just a precaution. They're patrolling the skies anyway under the code Orange Alert, and so they've decided to take the extra step to make sure that the flights are on their course and they aren't flying into buildings, for example. And as we know in the past, that they do have orders, if they do believe that the plane is hijacked, to strike and shoot down that aircraft.
Well, Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Gu, airline security reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us from Washington. U.S. officials are now confirming a report in this morning's USA Today that North Korea will allow a U.S. delegation to visit its main nuclear complex next week. The first such inspection in Yongbyon since North Korea expelled United Nations monitors a year ago. The news was reported by USA Today diplomatic writer Barbara Slavin, who joins us on the line. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you.
And what is your thinking? Why is North Korea doing this at this time?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. This is not an official U.S. delegation. It's what's called Track 2 diplomacy. This is a group of officials, including a former State Department official, two congressional aides, the former head of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, that's been invited by the North Koreans. And there's a lot of speculation about their motives. Something perhaps that they want to finally show the world that they do indeed have nuclear weapons. There's been a lot of ambiguity about this over the years.
And why would they want to show people that they have nuclear weapons?
Well, the North Koreans have been feeling a bit neglected while the United States has been focused on Iraq, in particular Libya, Iran, other countries. They've been jumping up and down and saying, we have nuclear weapons, and very eager to reach some sort of deal with the United States that would get them diplomatic and economic concessions. The Bush administration has refused to have direct negotiations with the North Koreans for over a year. It's only been willing to speak to the North Korean officials as part of a multinational procedure that's been going on in China. And so I think this is a way for the North Koreans to cut through all of that and speak directly to Americans who are influential and who I think they hope will influence the Bush administration.
Mm. And would you do us a favor and just tick through some of the events since 2002 when North Korea said that they had this secret program that brought us to today?
Well, maybe we should go back a little earlier. I mean, the Clinton administration was involved in negotiations with North Korea. Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, went there in 2000. We were close to concluding an agreement under which the North Koreans would have given up their missile program. Bush administration came in. The State Department wanted to continue those talks, but they were overruled by the White House, by the Pentagon, and essentially relations went nowhere with the North Koreans. It took months and months and months to get an agreement to meet. Direct talks didn't take place until October of 2002. At that time, the American delegation showed the North Koreans or confronted the North Koreans with evidence that they had a secret program to enrich uranium. And the North Koreans rather defiantly came back and said, yes, we do, and what are you going to do about it? Mm. And at that point, talks broke off. The Americans left. We cut off deliveries of heavy fuel oil, which had been promised to the North Koreans under a previous agreement reached in 1994, under which they froze their program at Yongbyon. This is a plutonium-based program. And we cut off the fuel oil. The North Koreans kicked out UN weapons inspectors, and they withdrew from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Mm-hmm. What's important about this upcoming visit is that it will be the first time that foreigners will be allowed to go to this Yongbyon site and see whether, indeed, the North Koreans have been reprocessing used nuclear fuel, whether they have any bombs. You know, we just don't know.
And, Barbara, you mentioned at the start that one of the reasons they might be doing this now is to sort of get everyone's attention. Mm-hmm. But is it also possible that they might be reacting to what they're seeing internationally, mm-hmm. Libya, Iran, other countries?
Yes, indeed. I mean, the North Koreans have been very clear. They say they are ready to trade their nuclear program for the appropriate concessions. The question is whether the Bush administration is willing to get involved in detailed negotiations with the North Koreans, whether the North Koreans can satisfy Bush administration concerns that they've really given up their program.
Do you think there's any fear on North Korea's part that, geez, gulp, we could be next after seeing Saddam Hussein?
I don't think so in the sense that they believe the United States would attack them. But it's a desperately poor country. They don't really produce very much that's usable except for weapons. And I think they see a deal as a way to ensure the regime's survival.
Barbara, thank you.
You're welcome.
Barbara Slavin, senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today. A French journalist says he was fired for publishing a book in which he criticizes French coverage of the American-led Iraq war. Alain Hertog, deputy editor of the website for La Croix daily newspaper, published his book, Outrageous War, The Way the Media Misled Us in Iraq, in October. He was let go by his paper for violating an employment clause that prohibits journalists from damaging their newspaper's interests. Alain Hertog joins us now from his holiday in Tunisia. Welcome.
Thank you for talking with me.
Well, tell me what you think. I mean, just tick off to start some of the things that you said in your book that you think, frankly, ticked off your newspaper.
Basically, there was an ideological, patriotic atmosphere in France before and during the war in Iraq. And the way the five newspapers I spoke about in the book told the war to the readers was more patriotic than journalistic.
For instance, give me an example of something that newspaper readers in France didn't know about because you say the papers didn't tell them.
3 days after the beginning of the war, there were a few deaths, there were a few prisoners in the American army, and immediately in the French press, the story was that there was a huge resistance from the Iraqis, and 2 or 3 days after, they were speaking about a quagmire, they were speaking about Vietnam. Even two newspapers, Le Monde and Le Figaro, told the readers that if the American army won so easily the battle in Baghdad, it's because they were so brutal and killing civilians, not taking care of the civilians.
Why is this happening? Why would esteemed French newspapers ignore what you say was the truth coming out of Iraq?
You needed to be in France at that time to understand. There was an incredible patriotic atmosphere with a very strong anti-Americanism. And then you had also, I think, an enormous nostalgia for the times when France was an important player on the international scene. And then also maybe some kind of Arabophilia that sometimes in these times of the war meant some kind of complacence with dictatorial Arab regime in the name of a so-called French Arab policy.
Since the capture of Saddam Hussein and the shift in power in Iraq, has there been a shift in opinion in France?
Basically, the 3 weeks of the war were exceptional. Today you have more diversity in what you can read in the newspapers.
I'm reading a column in one of the papers that you say is one of the worst offenders in its war coverage that's actually been very supportive of you because you've been fired.
It's not the staff that wrote that column.
Right.
It's a columnist. He writes once a week, and his contract is that he has total freedom. And his name is Daniel Schneiderman, and Daniel Schneiderman was fired from Le Monde in September because he wrote a book speaking about his own newspaper like me.
Well, Alain, what are you going to do now?
What I am waiting now is to see if there is room for a journalist like me in the French press.
Mm. Well, keep us posted, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alain Hertog, the author of Outrageous War, The Way the Media Misled Us in Iraq. And later in the program, author Michael Pollan. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Three Los Angeles Times reporters celebrating New Year's Eve were among the people injured in this week's deadly bombing at a Baghdad restaurant, underscoring the danger of reporting in a war zone. Of course, there's nothing those reporters could have done to protect themselves from a car bomb. But another reporter is taking his security into his own hands, and it's raising a lot of questions. Dexter Filkins of the New York Times carries a gun when he covers attacks on civilians and soldiers in Iraq, bucking the traditional wisdom that reporters who arm themselves confuse the enemy, who might think they're a combatant or a spy. But there is nothing traditional about recent warfare, and newsrooms are rethinking the security of their correspondents in the field. Should journalists carry guns? That's the question we're placing before our editorial roundtable today. Joining us on the line are Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan. Hi, Nolan.
Hello, Robin.
And Alicia Blaisdell-Bannon, managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Robin.
And Happy New Year to you both.
To you, too.
Yeah. Well, this issue came up during the war when Geraldo Rivera bragged about his weaponry, but this is a respected New York Times reporter. Who, by the way, hasn't commented on the alleged gun. Nolan, to you first. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm not real comfortable with it. I don't know that it necessarily makes him safer. And in fact, I would agree with the traditional wisdom that it is confusing and might place him in more danger because it does confuse the people he interacts with there. I would rather, if he felt the need for that sort of protection, I would rather see the hiring of a security bodyguard or some sort of security officer to travel with him.
Well, Alicia, in fact, CNN and other groups have hired security guards, and they've come under criticism for that because, again, it gives the impression that the reporters are somehow armed, even if it's the guard that's armed.
Yeah, and actually what that CNN security crew came under attack for was they fired back. Which I thought was sort of ironic. I guess if you're going to bring armed people with you, you should expect that they're going to fire back if you're fired on.
Right, and in that case, CNN points out, a car had pulled up alongside their convoy and was shooting into the car. All
right.
Their people would have been slaughtered.
Right. And I think that that's part of this issue is I'm not so sure in the case of a lone reporter carrying what I assume is some kind of a sidearm, how safe that protects them from the real dangers in situations like Baghdad.
Yeah.
And then even beyond that, would a gun might have saved Danny Pearl.
Yeah,
that's possible. But what would the outfall have been for other reporters who put themselves in danger? I think that's the issue they're going to have to decide at the Times.
It's funny you mentioned Danny Pearl because I found myself thinking, what would Danny Pearl do? And he would seem like the kind of journalist who would, despite his horrible execution, still rather not have had a gun. But, Nolan, the Committee to Protect Journalists points out that most journalists who die in war zones are, as Danny Pearl was, targeted and murdered. They're not killed in action. So doesn't that add to this thinking that, times have changed, and if they're going to be targeted, they need to defend themselves?
Well, there's no question about that. It's just, what's your status? You're not a soldier. I mean, what's the fallout? What's the potential to create a much, much greater incident? Now, I believe that if journalists are going to be targeted in places where they have, like the Middle East, where they have no respect for the press and no understanding of the importance of journalists in the regions, that there should you have to protect them somehow. I just don't feel that a reporter walking around packing heat is the appropriate way.
Alicia, in my reading, I came across a war correspondent from the New York Times, John Kiffner, who said he never even wore his flak jacket when he was reporting from Lebanon because he felt it was a barrier to talk to people.
That's right. I read that also, and I kind of wonder also where this would stop if we began to allow or encourage reporters to carry guns. I'm reading this morning that there were 599 murders in Chicago last year. What do we say to our colleagues?
Absolutely.
For the Chicago papers who go into neighborhoods exactly where they may fear for their lives, we ask reporters all the time to knock on strange doors, to go into situations at night where they're unfamiliar with their surroundings, and where do we say your life is in danger enough for you to carry a weapon.
Nolan, have you ever come across that? Would you ever let a reporter carry a gun?
Absolutely not.
Well, I tell you, it's a story that isn't going to go away, and it's in flux right now as, you know, we come across, as you've both pointed out, very different situations for journalists. But before we let you go, I want to continue to look ahead to the new year and what you each think might be the big story in the coming year, absent the presidential election or the continuing war in Iraq. Alicia, let's start with you first on the Cape.
On the Cape, I think in the general sense, it will continue to be our housing crisis. Expensive housing, where is everyone going to live? That will be the broader story that we'll be covering all year. I think the specific story is going to be the flyover that they're going to build from one side of the Cape Cod Canal, replacing the infamous rotary where tourists come down and get clogged up at the bridges. So.
I'm very upset about these circles, which drive most people crazy, and I kind of enjoy them myself.
Well, it depends how you feel about anarchy. That's the deal. If you're for anarchy, you'll love those traffic circles.
You're not kidding. And Nolan, in Detroit.
Well, in Detroit, it will be the same as nationally, I think, is whether this economic recovery will reach down and start creating jobs for people who have lost their jobs. Over the last 3 years, we've lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs in this country, 200,000 of them in Michigan. And so far with the recovery, those jobs haven't come back. And so what people will be looking for is to see if something comes along similar to the technology boom that creates some very good paying jobs to replace the ones we've lost. Our auto show starts this weekend, and there's a lot of concern but also a lot of hope that we'll be able to turn things around this year.
Mm. We'll keep an eye on that. Meantime, have you both seen in your papers, are your papers just a little bit heavier going into the new year? Have you got those extra help wanted ads?
We wish.
No, not yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
our recovery usually happens about 3 days before the next recession starts.
Well, help wanted ads did rise in November in general, and they say that's a sign the economy is rebounding a bit, so we hope your paper gets fatter in the new year as well. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Alicia Blaisdell Bannon, managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan. Next week on Here and Now, presidential politics. As we continue our conversations with the candidates, we'll talk with Al Sharpton. There's more coming up here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Michael Pollan on Mad Cow and Beyond. What are Americans eating?
What I really think is the significance of what's happened is not necessarily the risk to the consumer. I think what's significant is what we're all learning about the food chain we're part of. And frankly, it's kind of disgusting.
And movies that could use a New Year's resolution to slim down.
Unless you're parting the Red Sea or burning down Atlanta, your film does not need to come anywhere near 3 hours.
Hear, hear. These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. British Airways has grounded Flight 223 from London to Washington for the second straight day. There's not much detail from U.S. or British authorities, but British Airways says it acted after getting security advice from the British government. Flight 223 made its way to Washington on Wednesday, but was held on the Dulles taxiway for several hours while U.S. agents went aboard. Six cases of mistaken identity were responsible for the grounding of six Air France flights between Paris and Los Angeles. According to officials, the names of six passengers were similar to those of terrorist suspects provided by the FBI. French police officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, said errors in spelling and transcription of Arabic names played a role in the mix-up. A Tennessee man will be in a court in Hawaii later today after allegedly trying to enter the cockpit of an airplane. 31-year-old Brandon Rhines was arrested yesterday at Honolulu International Airport after his Northwest Airlines flight from Detroit landed. Rhines faces a charge of interfering with a flight crew. The FBI says the incident does not appear to be terrorism-related. Enemy ground fire is being blamed for the fatal crash of a U.S. Army helicopter in Fallujah. Lourdes Navarro reports.
The U.S. military says that one soldier has been killed and another has been wounded after a Kiowa observation helicopter belonging to the 82nd Airborne Division crashed near the restive town of Fallujah. The military now says an initial investigation has shown that the aircraft was hit by ground fire from insurgents. Rebels have made U.S. helicopters a frequent target of attacks in recent months. The single deadliest incident since the war began was also due to a helicopter hit. 17 soldiers were killed in Mosul when two Black Hawks collided in midair after what the military said was a probable grenade attack. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
The U.S. is considering sending Senator Elizabeth Dole to Iran as part of a mission to deliver earthquake relief. A Bush administration source says a member of the President Bush's family may also be sent if the trip gets the green light. Meanwhile, an unattributed commentary on Iran's state-run radio accused President Bush of using the quake aid as a cover to meddle in Iran's affairs and create rifts. It says Washington should thaw billions of dollars in frozen Iranian assets instead of sending what it calls meager aid. On Wall Street, the stock markets are up on this first trading day of 2004. The Dow is up 26 points at 10,480. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is away. It's Here and Now. The fallout from this country's single known case of mad cow disease continues today. Washington state officials are trying to track down the offspring of the now famous dairy cow, but reports say the lack of a specific tracking mechanism is making that difficult. Meanwhile, federal investigators are also reported to be running into trouble as they attempt to find out what happened to the 81 other animals that crossed the border from Canada in the original shipment over 2 years ago. One person who has followed an animal all the way through the production system is journalist Michael Pollan. Several years ago, he bought himself a calf, number 534, and documented its journey all the way from a ranch in South Dakota through a big industrial feedlot to the freezer. In the process, he learned a thing or two about how American beef is produced. Michael Pollan writes regularly about food issues for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of the book, The Botany of Desire, and he joins us now. Michael, hello.
Hello.
Well, first of all, to the current news, is this a surprise to you, the apparent inability of agriculture officials to trace cattle through the system?
I'm afraid it's not. I mean, the record keeping, you know, we don't have a lot of traceability in our food supply, and it's one of the many problems with a long, complicated, and largely opaque food chain. It's a complicated system, and if you ask a rancher who's owning his cattle right through to slaughter, well, what do they eat on the feedlot? He really doesn't know. Mm-hmm. In fact, the rancher I worked with, I remember saying to him, you know, I was really shocked to learn that cows in America up till 1997 had been eating other cows, that they were being reared as cannibals. And he said, well, frankly, I was shocked too.
Hmm. What about this case of BSE or mad cow disease? Your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, you know, I have to say it is something that was bound to happen sooner or later. I think that the industry had some sense of this because they were certainly well prepared for it. First, because mad cow does arise spontaneously, and they think about one in a million animals, and this may well be a case of that. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we weren't testing that widely. I mean, and so that's what made it hard to find and perhaps made it take as long as it has.
Mm-hmm.
What I really think is the significance of what's happened, though, is not necessarily the risk to the consumer. I mean, who knows how much higher that risk is today than it was 2 weeks ago. And the risk either way is very small, probably. I think what's significant is what we're all learning about the food chain we're part of. And frankly, it's kind of disgusting.
Well, and let's talk about that. For one of your best-known articles, you bought a calf, followed it all the way through the system, and ended up in the freezer. A big part of the article is about how most American beef is fed. Can you just tell us the points that you learned that you think are most important about just how American beef is fed?
Well, I would say there are two large points. I mean, one is that here you have this animal, a ruminant. What that means is it has this remarkable digestive organ that can convert grass and really, you know, not great land into an excellent source of protein because cows can digest grass, which humans cannot. So the sun feeds the grass, and the grass feeds the ruminants, and the ruminants feed us. It's this, you know, very elegant, sustainable food chain. But it isn't efficient enough for the industry, so that they need a source of protein and calories, energy, basically, that will get that animal to slaughter much more quickly.
Does it take longer for a cow to beef up on grass?
Yes. I mean, okay. Cows that live their lives on grass don't reach a slaughter weight of, say, 1,100 pounds nearly as quickly as the ones that are put on a feedlot, fed corn, fed protein supplements, which, you know, have in the past contained meat and bone meal from other cows, and hormones and antibiotics. I mean, all these things basically cut in half the length of that cow's life before it's ready for slaughter. And in American business, time is money. So we have moved to a system that is very efficient. After all, beef used to be a luxury item on American tables. It's something that only the middle class really had, and they only had it once a week. Now we can eat meat three times a day in this country.
Would the industry collapse if, for instance, cows went back to being grass-fed?
Well, there's no way of knowing, and as a journalist, I try not to speculate, but to have 100 million cows, as I think is approximately the population, all put back on grass right now, you would have to make a lot of changes. There isn't enough rangeland out west. On the other hand, the land those cows are really eating off of is the grain belt, the corn belt in the Midwest, because they eat all the corn and soybeans coming out of the Mississippi Basin. So if you turned a lot of that land back to prairie, you could put a whole lot of animals back on grass. You know how practical that solution is? I have no idea. But it would be better for the animals, it would be better for us. And that's the key thing, because these animals have not evolved to eat corn. These animals have clearly not evolved to eat their own flesh. And we need to remember that one of the things we learned in this scandal is that although we did stop, we think we stopped feeding them meat and bone meal, compliance is a real issue here, we're still feeding them tallow, which is fat from other cows, and we're still feeding calves blood, which has protein in it, from other cows.
Michael, one of the striking things about your experience is that you met ranchers who aren't crazy about the system either and feel they're forced into it by economic imperatives.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, ranchers trying to do good work, and they're in the business their parents and grandparents were in, and suddenly they find they cannot compete unless, for example, they give their animals hormone implants. And I would ask them, well, you know, you don't feel good about it. You don't like feeding your children meat that's been treated with hormones. So why do you do it? And they say, well, it costs a buck or two to put the implant in it, and it adds 50 pounds to the animal's weight at slaughter, and that is my margin. I will not be able to survive unless I keep up. And then if you ask the whole industry, why don't you stop doing this thing, they say, well, it would hurt us competitively. And I said, no. What if everybody stopped? And they said, yes, then the chicken people would have an edge. See, they're selling protein, and they compete with chicken, which is a much more efficient way of turning corn into protein. So that it is a competitive spiral that everybody gets caught up with. And that's why you need the government to set the rules, even if it costs a few more cents to make the meat supply safer. You need the government to say, we're going to do it. It's not going to be the industry that's going to come up with this on its own.
Michael, we only have a few seconds. I know you're a meat eater, but after what you've learned, how do you be a better meat eater?
Well, I'm much more careful. I really like to find out where the meat I eat came from. You know, there are a lot of alternatives. We're not stuck with this food chain now. One of the great things that's happened in the last few years is that alternative food chains are coming forward. And with our consumer dollars, we can support them. And there is grass-fed meat now in the market and on menus, and there's plenty of organic meat, which is still, you know, uses corn but does not use these other non-vegetarian feeds.
We haven't really touched on how you feel about the rights of the animals themselves. I mean, you try very hard not to be sentimental about this, but is there an aspect of that for you as well?
Sure. I mean, there is a humane issue here. Raising animals on feedlots, these are not happy animals. It's very hard to say what's going on in a cow or a steer's mind. But animals, you know, these animals evolved to live on grass, and they're a lot more happy doing so. And I feel better eating the meat of animals that have had a happy life and hopefully one bad day at the slaughterhouse.
Michael Pollan, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Michael Pollan, author of the book The Botany of Desire, also author of an upcoming New York Times Magazine essay on mad cow disease. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Well, we just heard from author Michael Pollan. Now joining us is Dr. Gary Weber. He's Executive Director of Regulatory Affairs and an animal scientist for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association in Washington, D.C. Doctor, welcome.
Hello.
First off, in regards to mad cow, is American beef safe?
Absolutely. You know, one of the most important things that consumers know and that we depend on is the government's inspection system, the government's approval process for all the practices that we undertake in American agriculture. And from that perspective, I think it's very clear from the discussions and the debates and the information over the last week that consumers can see what the government does every day.
But on the other hand, you know, we're hearing that they can't track the animals. They're still trying to find the rest of the herd that the infected cow was in. And cows are still being fed ground-up animals. Even they're no longer cannibalizing and eating other cows, but they're still eating protein from ground-up animals. Isn't this dangerous?
Well, the most important thing to remember relative to tracing is that animal identification and traceability does not make food safe. Our food safety inspection system, the veterinarians that inspect every animal when it arrives at the plant, and all through the production process, veterinarians inspect every animal every day, all day. That's what makes food safe, not an identification system.
What about what they eat? And specifically what Michael and others are talking about, the idea that these are animals that were created to eat grass.
we have found over time that adding certain forms of protein could enhance animal productivity. Now, since 1997, the use of products that could carry the mad cow agent, the BSE agent, that has been stopped, and we're very confident in the United States those restrictions are enforced fully to protect the health of our cattle herd.
Dr. Weber, we're hearing, and Michael Pollan documents this, even from cattlemen who hate the system. They hate it on a lot of different levels, and one of them is the emotional level. The turnover, apparently, at feedlots is huge, the turnover at slaughterhouses. Why not convert to a system where not only will the animals be healthier, they're allowed to graze, they take longer to beef up, but humans will get healthier meat, and the people who work with them are happier, as are the cows?
Well, number one, I work with producers every day. I represent them. They pay my salary here to represent them in Washington, and they are not disturbed by our system. They know that the food is safe. They know animals are well cared for.
As you point out, there are consumers who are demanding free-range beef that's grass-fed and not fed on corn and the other additives. Do you ever fear that that push might become so big that, let's say, like the tobacco industry, your industry might have to really make a sea change?
Consumer confidence in the safety of beef has climbed every year since BSE was first identified as an issue in 1996. So we're confident that our consumers understand and have confidence that we are producing safe beef in the United States.
What about the value people attach to the feelings of the cow? You know, that they get to range maybe for 5 years and have that happy life as opposed to being rushed to slaughter at 12 to 14 months, which is what's happening now.
Well, the animals, actually, the average age is somewhere around 2 years. And if you've ever been in a feedlot and you watch on a spring day the cattle kicking up their heels and running with their tails up, you'd know that they enjoy that environment where they don't have to range all over for food and feed. They've got water right there. They are very content and very, very safe in those settings.
Geez, I have been in a feedlot, and there's a lot of manure and a lot of constraint.
They're not constrained. They have room to move around. They have free access to food and water. And again, you've got to watch their behavior. And if you ask animal behavior experts, they're going to say there's all this evidence that these cattle are content.
Gary Weber, speaking for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's January 2nd, time to try to follow through on all those New Year's resolutions. Some are trying to cut down on calories, but while sitting through some of this season's holiday fare at the movie theater, Master and Commander, The Last Samurai, Cold Mountain, our film reviewers wondered, how about cutting down on length? All the winter blockbusters clocked in at around 2.5 hours. Lord of the Rings is 3.5. A film critic at the Boston Globe said that seeing Lord of the Rings required buns of steel. Well, our own critics, Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham, concur, and they're here in the studio to talk a little bit about the fat on movies. Hello to you both.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, Robin.
And this is probably why are the films getting longer and longer, Renee?
I just think there's this tendency among directors to think that if the film is longer, it makes the film more important. You know, short subjects can't be told in 2 hours. You need 3 hours. You need 3.5 hours. And especially at this time of year, where these are all the big prestige films for the Oscars, the films just keep getting longer and longer. And in most cases, they don't need to be.
Give us an example, Eric.
Well, why don't we just start out with a couple of the recent films, like Cold Mountain, a movie that clocks in at almost 2.5 hours, way too long, could have easily been trimmed, or something like The Last Samurai, which runs almost 2.5 hours and could have had 20 minutes clipped out of it without a problem.
Right. And is this just because you you both see so many movies. Do you think there's an element of that to it, Renee?
No. You'd think on one level we'd be used to it. I think it's the people who don't see a lot of films who are just shocked by how long these films run. I think unless you're parting the Red Sea or burning down Atlanta, your film does not need to come anywhere near 3 hours.
And this is not just a recent problem. I know, Renee, you have a pick that it's not a new movie at all.
No, I think the first film where it really hit me was in 1992 with Spike Lee's film bio of Malcolm X, which is really a very compelling film. It has this electrifying performance by Denzel Washington as Malcolm X, but Spike just overplays his hand. The film, Malcolm X in the film is assassinated at about the 3 hour, 3 minute mark. Ozzie Davis gives his Malcolm X eulogy, and that's the natural ending for the film. And then you just, at the end, you have school children. There's a scene, and they're standing up, and they're saying, I am Malcolm X. And by that point, you're just like, Spike, enough. Mm-hmm. You know, we got the point.
He was a great, great Afro-American. And Malcolm X is you, all of you. And you are Malcolm X.
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
I am Malcolm X.
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 It's almost as if he doesn't trust himself with his ability to tell the story. He has to drive the point home one more time. Mm. And it threw the film off for me so much because it just took you out of the moment, you know, where you should have ended with Ozzie Davis's eulogy.
See, now, maybe I'm the wrong person for this because I love not only when movies go on, but that new trend towards putting outtakes in the credits.
Well, see, that's one of the problems I think we have now. Because of DVDs and the necessity to have so much extra stuff on DVD, they're shooting more than they normally would. Nobody writes a nice, compact, clean script anymore. They include a lot of extra scenes, and then that always winds up in your, you know, DVD package. And unfortunately, a lot of the extraneous stuff winds up in the theatrical cut, too.
Well, come on. When at the end of Ants, all the Ant characters did all the outtakes. Was it Ants that I'm thinking of?
They do that. And that can be funny. Those can be very funny, but that's sort of separate from the actual story.
Right.
When you're at the three-hour mark and you're looking at your watch and you realize, oh, wow, this film isn't really near ending, or you've got all
I'm
these false endings.
I'm starving to death.
Mm-hmm. You know, or, you know, you have to really plan your fluids to go see these films.
Eric, you have a candidate.
Yeah, I have a candidate. It was a really fun film from this past year, Pirates of the Caribbean, a movie that I liked a lot, but it clocked in at about 2 hours and 20 minutes. And this is a movie that could have easily been trimmed some. It has a great performance by Johnny Depp.
Get away from there! You don't have permission to be aboard there, mate.
I'm sorry, it's such a pretty boat. Ship.
What's your name?
Smith. Oh, Smithy, if you like.
What's your purpose in Port Royal, Mr. Smith? Yeah, and no lies.
All right, then. I confess. It is my intention to commandeer one of these ships, pick up a crew in Tortuga, raid, pillage, plunder, and otherwise pilfer my Weasley black guts out.
But he's often lost amidst all the extraneous special effects. And I think special effects have a lot to do with why movies have gotten so big. They invest so much money and so much time into creating these effects, they are, you know, scared to death about cutting any of them. So even if, you know, certain sequences are not necessary or if they go on too long, by gosh, we're not going to leave any of that CGI stuff out because we paid for it.
But, you know, but there are people who love that movie and they leave wanting more. And, Renee, I'm thinking your next pick. You're tampering with something here because this is one of the most popular movies ever.
Although I think there was some recent poll from some British film society that actually said Titanic was the worst film of all time. It is, however, the highest grossing film of all time, too. Just before the film came out, the director, James Cameron, used to joke, half-jokingly would say the film was actually 2 hours and 74 minutes because he just couldn't own up with the fact that this film was comfortably over 3 hours. And it's just...
Or uncomfortably.
Uncomfortably over 3 hours. And, you know, there was a moment where I remember I was just rooting for the iceberg, which is like, get to the iceberg, kill them, get them out of here. It just goes on and on. You know, it took the Titanic from the moment it actually hit the iceberg 2 hours and 40 minutes to sink. James Cameron's movie is nowhere near 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's just so long, and it just there's all these scenes you don't need. And I think it's one of those films because of that, which hasn't aged. I didn't like it when it came out, but it hasn't aged especially well since it came out in 1997.
What do you mean people aren't renting it? It isn't.
People aren't renting it, and people have sort of gone back and looked at the film and realized it just goes on forever. And it, you know, what you want to see in the Titanic is the iceberg, and you want to see the ship go down. You don't want 2.5 hours of Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet and Billy Zane in this remarkably silly love triangle.
Go on. I'll get the next one.
No, not without you.
I'll be all right. Listen, I'll be fine. I'm a survivor, all right? Don't worry about me. Now go on. Get on.
I have an arrangement with an officer on the other side of the ship. Jack and I can get off safely. Both of us.
Sinking under its own weight, Titanic. But Eric, remind us, what in the good old days, what was the average length of a film?
Well, I think, you know, back in the good old days, a prestige film usually came in at 2 hours. Now a prestige film will come in at, you know, 2.5 or 3 hours. And, you know, your basic run-of-the-mill new release would have been, you know, maybe 90 minutes to an hour and 45 minutes, something like that. You know, one of the big problems is these days is that directors have this incredible amount of power. They often have Final Cut written into their contracts, and they don't have anyone over them, a producer or a studio executive who has the power to say, take this thing back into the editing room and trim some of the fat out of it. Mm-hmm. Those days are gone.
Mm-hmm. I think of a film like David Lean's Brief Encounter, which runs 87 minutes. I can imagine if that film was remade today, Brief Encounter would probably run 2 hours and 45 minutes. It seems like people are incapable of making a film at a reasonable length.
The art of pacing has disappeared.
Completely.
Then again, his name was David Lean. I'm sorry. I couldn't help. From each of you, before we let you go into the new year, if there was a director who you wish would make a New Year's resolution for a shorter movie, one in particular, you've already mentioned Spike Reneé, another one.
Anthony Minghella, who's the director of Cold Mountain, but he also directed The English Patient.
Now, see, I loved that.
Don't get me started on this movie.
Don't get me started either, Rob.
Okay, apparently. Eric, your candidate?
Steven Spielberg. I mean, you know, here's a guy who, you know, is capable of making good movies from time to time, but...
What?
No,
Steven Spielberg
Spielberg is a good director. He'd be a better director if he learned how to edit. You know, even something like last year's Catch Me If You Can, which was a fairly fun movie, that was a good 20 minutes too long. It would have been a great movie if he had, you know, known how to edit that thing down some.
Okay. I'm sure there are a lot of listeners agreeing, especially remembering the agony of sitting through a long movie, and there are a lot of listeners saying, yeah, Steven Spielberg needs advice from us, but we take it anyway, and thank you both so much. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Rob.
And here's wishing you shorter, better movies in the new year. Here are now film critics Renee Graham and Eric Schaefer on films that are too fat and... Oh, Eric, it's Stephen calling. And in fact, the emails are already pouring in from people who love their long movies. Remember, you can always let us know what you think about anything on the program at letters@here-now.org. Address them to Eric and Renee, though. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio. Have a great weekend. And join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The New Hampshire primary is approaching. We'll talk with Democratic candidate Al Sharpton and celebrating the music of American composer Charles Ives. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.